existence again. To take the pill for the physical pain that I knew would numb me to the internal pain. It was in these moments that I realized that I had my own jury to face, and that the coming verdict was guilty, that there would be no more cases after this one. I went outside to the deck, hoping the city could pull me out of the abyss into which I had fallen. The night was cool and crisp and clear. Los Angeles spread out in front of me in a carpet of lights, each one a verdict on a dream somewhere. Some people lived the dream, and some didn't. Some people cashed in their dreams a dime on the dollar, and some kept them close and as sacred as the night. I wasn't sure if I even had a dream left. I felt like I only had sins to confess. After a while, a memory washed over me, and somehow I smiled. It was one of my last clear memories of my father, the greatest lawyer of his time. An antique glass ball, an heirloom from Mexico passed down through my mother's family, had been found broken beneath the Christmas tree. My mother brought me to the living room to view the damage and to give me the chance to confess my guilt. By then, my father was sick and wasn't going to get better. He had moved his work, what was left of it, home to the study next to the living room. I didn't see him through the open door, but from that room I heard his voice in a sing-song nursery rhyme. In a pickle, take the nickel. I knew what it meant. Even at 5 years old, I was my father's son in blood and the law. I refused to answer my mother's questions. I refused to incriminate myself. Now I laughed out loud as I looked at the city of dreams. I leaned down, elbows on the railing, and bowed my head. I can't do this anymore, I whispered to myself. The song of the Lone Ranger suddenly burst from the open door behind me. I stepped back inside and looked at the cell phone left on the table with my keys. The screen said private number. I hesitated, knowing exactly how long the song would play before the call went to message. At the last moment, I took the call.
Is this Michael Haller, the lawyer?
Yes, who is this?
This is Los Angeles Police Officer Randall Morris. Do you know an individual named Elaine Ross, sir?
I felt a fist grip my guts.
Laney?
Yes. What happened? What's wrong?
Sir, I have Miss Ross up here on Mulholland Drive, and she shouldn't be driving. In fact, she sort of passed out after she handed me your card.
I closed my eyes for a moment. The call seemed to confirm my fears about Laney Ross. She had fallen back. An arrest would put her back into the system and probably cost her another stay in jail and rehab.
Which jail are you taking her to? I asked. I gotta be honest, Mr. Haller. I'm code 7 in 20 minutes. If I take her down to Booker, I'm looking at 2 more hours and I'm tapped on my overtime allowance this month. I was going to say, if you can come get her or send somebody for her, I'm willing to give her the break. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Officer Morris. I'll come get her if you give me the address.
You know where the overlook is above Fryman Canyon?
Yes, I do.
We're right here. Make it quick.
I'll be there in less than 15 minutes. Fryman Canyon was only a few blocks from the converted garage guest house where a friend allowed Laney to live rent-free. I could get her home, walk back to the park, and retrieve her car afterward. It would take me less than an hour, and it would keep Laney out of jail and her car out of the tow lot. I left the house and drove Laurel Canyon up the hill to Mulholland. When I reached the top, I took a left and headed west. I lowered the windows and let the cool air in as I felt the first pulls of fatigue from the day grab me. I followed the serpentine road for half a mile, slowing once when my headlights washed across a scruffy coyote standing vigil on the side of the road. My cell phone buzzed as I had been expecting it to.
What took you so long to call, Bosch?
I said by way of a greeting.
I've been calling, but there's no cell coverage in the canyon, Bosch said. Is this some kind of test? Where the hell are you going? You called and said you were done for the night.
I got a call. A client of mine got busted on a deuce up here. The cop's giving her a break if I drive her home.
From where?
The Fryman Canyon Overlook. I'm almost there.
Who was the cop?
Randall Morris. He didn't say whether he was Hollywood or North Hollywood.
Mulholland was a boundary between the two police divisions. Morris could work out of either one.
Okay, pull over until I could check it out.
Pull over? Where? Mulholland was a winding two-lane road, with no pullover spots except for the overlooks. If you pulled over anywhere else, you would get plowed into by the next car to come around the bend.
Then slow down!
I'm already here. The Fryman Canyon overlook was on the valley side. I took a right to turn in and drove right by the sign that said that the parking area was closed after sunset. I didn't see Laney's car or a police cruiser. The parking area was empty. I checked my watch. It had only been 12 minutes since I had told Officer Morris that I would be there in less than 15.
Damn!
What? Bosch asked. I hit the heel of my palm on the steering wheel. Morris hadn't waited. He'd gone ahead and taken Laney to jail.
What?
Bosch repeated. She's not here, I said, and neither is the cop. He took her to jail. I would now have to figure out which station Laney had been transported to and probably spend the rest of the night arranging bail and getting her home. I'd be wrecked in court the next day. I put the car in park and got out and looked around. The lights of the valley spread out below the precipice for miles and miles. Bosch, I gotta go. I have to try to find... I saw movement in my peripheral vision to the left. I turned and saw a crouching figure come out of the tall brush next to the parking clearing. At first I thought coyote, but then I saw that it was a man. He was dressed in black, and a ski mask was pulled down over his face. As he straightened from the crouch, I saw that he was raising a gun at me.
Wait a minute, I said. What is... Drop the fucking phone!
I dropped the phone and raised my hands.
Okay, what is this? Are you with Bosch?
The man moved quickly toward me and shoved me backwards. I stumbled to the ground and then felt him grab the back of my jacket's collar.
Get up!
What is...
Get up, now!
He started pulling me up.
Okay, I'm getting up!
The moment I was on my feet, I was shoved forward and crossed through the lights at the front of my car.
Where are we going? What is...
I was shoved again.
Who are you? Why are you...
You ask too many questions, lawyer!
He grabbed the back of my collar and shoved me toward the precipice. I knew it was almost a sheer drop-off at the edge. I was going to end up in somebody's backyard hot tub after a 300-foot high dive. I tried to dig my heels in and slow my forward momentum, but that resulted in an even harder shove. I had velocity now, and the man in the mask was going to run me off the edge into the blackness of the abyss.
You can't...
Suddenly there was a shot. Not from behind me, but from the right and from a distance. Almost simultaneously, there was a metal snapping sound from behind me, and the man in the mask yelped and fell into the brush to the left. Then came voices and shouting.
Drop your weapon! Drop your weapon! Get on the ground! Get down on the ground!
I dove face down to the dirt at the edge of the precipice and put my hands over my head for protection. I heard more yelling and the sound of running. I heard engines roaring and vehicles crunching across the gravel. When I opened my eyes, I saw blue lights flashing in repeated patterns off the dirt and brush. Blue lights meant cops. It meant I was safe.
Counselor, a voice said from above me, you can get up now.
I craned my neck to look up. It was Bosch, his shadowed face silhouetted by the stars above him.
You cut that one pretty close, he said.
The man in the black mask groaned in pain as they cuffed his hands behind his back.
My hand! Jesus, you assholes, my hand is broken!
I climbed to my feet and saw several men in black windbreakers moving about like ants on a hill. Some of the plastic raid jackets said LAPD on them, but most had FBI printed across the back. Soon a helicopter came overhead and lit the entire parking clearing with a spotlight.
Bosch stepped over to the FBI agents huddling over the man in the mask.
Was he hit?
He asked.
There is no wound, an agent said. The round must have hit the gun, but that still hurts like a son of a bitch.
Where is the gun?
We're still looking, the agent said.
It may have gone over the side, another agent said.
If we don't find it tonight, we find it in daylight, said a third.
They pulled the man up into a standing position. Two of the FBI agents stood on either side of him, holding him at the elbows.
Let's see who we've got, Bosch said.
The ski mask was unceremoniously yanked off, and a flashlight was aimed point blank at the man's face. Bosch turned and looked back at me.
Juror number 7, I said.
What are you talking about?
Juror number 7 from the trial. He didn't show up today, and the sheriff's department was looking for him.
Bosch turned back to the man I knew was named David McSweeney.
Hold him right there.
He then turned and signaled to me to follow him. He walked out of the circle of activity and into the parking clearing near my car. He stopped and turned back to me, but I got my question in first. What just happened?
What just happened was we just saved your life. He was going to push you over the side.
I know that, but what happened? Where did you and everybody else come from? You said you would let people go at night after I was tucked in. Where did all of these cops come from? And what's the FBI doing here?
Things were different tonight. Things happened.
What things happened? What changed?
We can go over that later. Let's talk about what we've got here first.
I don't know what we've got here.
Tell me about juror number 7. Why didn't he show up today?
Well, you should probably ask him that. All I can tell you is that this morning the judge called us into chambers and said he got an anonymous letter saying number 7 was a phony, and he lied about having a record. The judge planned to question him, but he didn't show up. The sheriffs were sent to his house and his job, and they brought back a guy who wasn't juror number 7.
Bosch raised his hands like a traffic cop.
Hold on, hold on, you're not making sense. I know you just had a scare, but...
He stopped when one of the men in an LAPD jacket came over to address him.
You want us to call paramedics? He says he thinks his hand is broken. No, just hold him there. We'll have him checked after we book him.
You sure?
Fuck him.
The man nodded and went back to the spot where they were holding McSweeney.
Yeah, fuck him, I said.
Why did he want to kill you? Bosch asked.
I raised my empty hands. I don't know. Maybe because of the story we planted. Wasn't that the plan, to draw him out?
I think you're holding out on me, Holler.
Look, I've told you what I could tell you all along. You're the one holding out and playing games. What's the FBI doing here?
They've been in it from the start.
Right, and you just forgot to tell me.
I told you what you needed to know.
Well, I need to know it all now, or my cooperation with you ends now. That includes being any sort of witness against that man over there.
I waited a moment, and he said nothing. I turned to walk toward my car, and Bosch put his hand on my arm. He smiled in frustration and shook his head.
Come on, man, cool your jets. Don't be throwing empty threats around.
You think it's an empty threat? Why don't we see how empty it is when I start stringing out the federal grand jury subpoena I know is going to come out of this? I can argue client confidentiality all the way to the Supreme Court. I bet that will only take about 2 years. And your newfound pals over in the Bureau are going to wish you had just come clean with me when you had the chance.
Bosch thought a moment and pulled me by the arm.
All right, tough guy, come over here.
We walked to a spot in the parking area, even further from the law enforcement anthill. Bosch started to talk.
The Bureau contacted me a few days after the Vincent murder and said that he had been a person of interest to them. That's all, a person of interest. He was one of the lawyers whose names came up in their look at the state courts. Nothing specific, just based on rumors. Things he had supposedly told clients he could get done, connections he claimed to have, that sort of thing. They'd drawn up a list of lawyers they heard might be bent, and Vincent was on it. They invited him in as a cooperating witness, and he declined. They were increasing the pressure on him when he got hit.
So they tell you all of this, and you join forces. Isn't that wonderful? Thanks for telling me.
Like I said, you didn't need to know.
A man in an FBI jacket crossed the parking area behind Bosch, and his face was momentarily lit from above. He looked familiar to me, but I couldn't place him. But then I imagined a mustache on him.
Hey, there's the asshole you sent after me the other night, I said loud enough for the passing agent to hear. He's lucky I didn't put a bullet in his face at the door.
Bosch put his hands on my chest and pushed me back a few steps.
Calm down, counselor. If it weren't for the Bureau, I wouldn't have had the manpower to keep the watch on you. And right now,
You could be lying down there at the bottom of the mountain.
I pushed his hands off me but settled down. My anger dissipated as I accepted the reality of what Bosch had just said, and the reality that I had been used as a pawn from the beginning, by my client and now by Bosch and the FBI.
Bosch took the moment to signal over another agent who was standing nearby watching.
This is Agent Armstead. He's been running the Bureau's side of things, and he's got some questions for you.
Why not? I said. Nobody answers mine. I might as well answer yours.
Armstead was a young, clean-cut agent with a precision military haircut.
Mr. Haller, we'll get to your questions as soon as we can, he said. Right now, we have a fluid situation here, and your cooperation will be greatly appreciated. Is juror number 7 the man Vincent paid the bribe to?
I looked at Bosch with a who-is-this-guy expression.
Man, how would I know that? I wasn't part of this thing. You want an answer to that? Go ask him.
Don't worry, we'll be asking him a lot of questions. What were you doing up here, Mr. Haller?
I told you people. I told Bosch.
I got a call from somebody who said he was a cop. He said he had a woman I know personally up here, and she was under the influence and that I could come up and drive her home and save her the trouble of getting booked on a deuce.
We checked that name you gave me on the phone, Bosch said.
There is one Randall Morris in the department. He's on gang detail in South Bureau.
I nodded.
Yeah, well, I think it's pretty clear now that it was a fake call. But he knew my friend's name and he had my cell. It seemed convincing at the time, all right?
How did he get the woman's name? Armstead asked.
Good question. I had a relationship with her, a platonic relationship, but I haven't talked to her in almost a month.
Then how would he know about her?
Man, you're asking me shit I don't know. Go ask McSweeney.
I immediately realized I had slipped up. I wouldn't know that name unless I had been investigating juror number 7.
Bosch looked at me curiously.
I didn't know if he realized the jury was supposed to be anonymous, even to the lawyers on the case. Before he could come up with a question, I was saved by someone yelling from the brush where I had almost been pushed over the side.
I've got the gun!
Bosch pointed a finger at my chest.
Stay right here.
I watched Bosch and Armstead trot over and join a few of the others as they studied the found weapon under a flashlight beam. Bosch didn't touch the weapon, but bent down into the light to examine it closely. The William Tell overture started to play behind me. I turned around and saw my phone lying on the gravel, its tiny square screen glowing like a beacon. I went over and picked it up. It was Cisco, and I took the call.
Cisco, I gotta call you back.
Make it quick. I've got some good shit for you. You're gonna wanna know this.
I closed the phone and watched as Bosch finished his study of the weapon and then stepped over to McSweeney. He leaned close to him and whispered something into his ear. He didn't wait for a response. He just turned and walked back toward me. I could tell, even in the dim moonlight, that he was excited. Armstead was following behind him.
The gun's a Beretta Bobcat, like we were looking for on Vincent, he said. If the ballistics match, then we've got that guy locked in a box. I'll make sure you get accommodation from City Hall.
Good, I'll frame it.
Put this together for me, Haller, and you can start with him being the one who killed Vincent. Why did he want to kill you too?
I don't know.
The bribe, Armstead asked. Is he the one who got the money?
Same answer I gave you 5 minutes ago. I don't know. But it makes sense, doesn't it?
How did he know your friend's name on the phone?
I don't know that either.
Then what good are you? Bosch asked.
It was a good question, and the immediate answer didn't sit well with me.
Look, detective, I... Don't bother, man. Why don't you just get in your car and get the fuck out of here? We'll take it from here.
He turned and started walking away, and Armstead followed. I hesitated, and then I called out to Bosch. I waved him back. He said something to the FBI agent and came back to me alone.
No bullshit, he said impatiently. I don't have the time.
Okay, this is the thing, I said. I think he was going to make it look like I jumped.
Bosch considered this and then shook his head. Suicide? Who would believe that?
You've got the case of the decade, man. You're hot. You're on TV. And you've got a kid to worry about. Suicide wouldn't sell. I nodded. Yes, it would. He looked at me and said nothing, waiting for me to explain. I'm a recovering addict, Bosch. You know anything about that? Why don't you tell me? The story would go that I couldn't take the pressure of the big case and all the attention, and I either had or was about to relapse. So I jumped instead of going back to that. It's not an uncommon thing, Bosch. They call it the fast out. And it makes me think that... What? I pointed across the clearing toward juror number 7. That he, and whoever he was doing this for, knew a lot about me. They did a deep background. They came up with my addiction and rehab and Lainey's name. Then they came up with a solid plan for getting rid of me, because they couldn't just shoot down another lawyer without bringing down massive scrutiny on what it is they've got going. If I went down as a suicide, there'd be a lot less pressure. Yeah, but why do they need to get rid of you? I guess they think I know too much. Do you? Before I could answer, McSweeney started yelling from the other side of the clearing.
Hey! Over there with the lawyer! I want to make a deal! I can give you some big people, man! I want to make a deal!
Bosch waited to see if there was more, but that was it. My tip? I said. Go over there and strike while the iron's hot, before he remembers he's entitled to a lawyer. Bosch nodded.
Thanks, coach, he said, but I think I know what I'm doing.
He started to head across the clearing.
Hey, Bosch, wait, I called. You owe me something before you go over there.
Bosch stopped and signaled to Armstead to go to McSweeney. He then came back to me. What do I owe you? One answer. Tonight I called you and told you I was in for the night. You were supposed to cut the surveillance down to one car, but this is the whole enchilada up here. What changed your mind?
You haven't heard, have you?
Heard what?
You get to sleep late tomorrow, counselor. There's no trial anymore.
Why not?
Because your client's dead. Somebody, probably our friend over there who wants to make a deal, took Elliot and his girlfriend out tonight when they came home from dinner. His electric gate wouldn't open, and when he got out to push it open, somebody came up and put a bullet in the back of his head. Then he hit the woman in the car. I took a half step back in shock. I knew the gate Bosch was talking about. I'd been to Elliot's mansion in Beverly Hills just the other night, and as far as the girlfriend went, I also thought I knew who that would be. I'd had Nina Albrecht figured for that position ever since Elliot told me he'd had help on the day of the murders in Malibu. Bosch didn't let the stunned look on my face keep him from continuing.
I got tip from a friend in the medical examiner's office and figured that somebody might be out there cleaning the slate tonight. I figured I ought to call the team back and see what happens at your place. Lucky for you, I did.
I stared right through Bosch when I answered. Yeah, I said. Lucky for me. There was no longer a trial, but I went to court on Tuesday morning to see the case through to its official end. I took my place next to the empty seat Walter Elliott had occupied for the past 2 weeks. The news photographers who had been allowed access to the courtroom seemed to like that empty chair. They took a lot of photos of it. Jeffrey Golant sat across the aisle. He was the luckiest prosecutor on earth. He had left court one day, thinking he was facing a career-hobbling loss, and came back the next day with his perfect record intact. His upward trajectory in the DA's office and city politics was safe for now. He had nothing to say to me as we sat and waited for the judge. But there was a lot of talk in the gallery. People were buzzing with news of the murders of Walter Elliott and Nina Albrecht. No one made mention of the attempt on my life and the events at the Fryman Canyon Overlook. For the moment, that was all secret. Once McSweeney told Bosch and Armstead that he wanted to deal, the investigators had asked me to keep quiet so they could move slowly and carefully with their cooperating suspect. I was happy to cooperate with that myself, to a point. Judge Stanton took the bench promptly at 9. His eyes were puffy, and he looked like he'd had very little sleep. I wondered if he knew as many details of what had transpired the night before as I did.
The jury was brought in, and I studied their faces. If any of them knew what had happened, they weren't showing it. I noticed several of them check out the empty seat beside me as they took their own.
"Ladies and gentlemen, good morning," the judge said. "At this time, I am going to discharge you from service in this trial. As I'm sure you can see, Mr. Elliott is not in his seat at the defense table. This is because the defendant in this trial was the victim of a homicide last night." Half of the jurors' mouths dropped open in unison. The others expressed their surprise with their eyes. A low murmur of excited voices went through the courtroom, and then a slow and deliberate clapping began from behind the prosecution table. I turned to see Mitzi Elliott's mother applauding the news of Elliott's demise. The judge brought his gavel down harshly, just as Golance jumped from his seat and rushed to her, grabbing her hands gently and stopping her from continuing. I saw tears rolling down her cheeks.
"There will be no demonstrations from the gallery," the judge said harshly. "I don't care who you are or what connection you might have to the case. Everyone in here will show respect to the court, or I will have you removed."
Golance returned to his seat, but the tears continued to flow from the mother of one of the victims.
"I know that to all of you, this is rather shocking news," Stanton told the jurors. "Be assured that the authorities are investigating the matter thoroughly, and hopefully will soon bring the individual or individuals responsible to justice. I am sure you will learn all about it when you read the paper or watch the news, as you are now free to do. As far as today goes, I want to thank you for your service. I know you all were very attentive to the presentation of the prosecution and defense cases, and I hope your time here was a positive experience. You are free now to go back to the deliberation room to gather your things and go home. You are excused."
We stood one last time for the jury, and I watched them file through the doorway to the deliberation room. After they were gone, the judge thanked Golance and me for our professional demeanor during trial, thanked his staff, and quickly adjourned court. I hadn't bothered to unpack any files from my bag, so I stood motionless for the longest time after the judge left the courtroom. My reverie wasn't broken until Golance approached me with his hand out. Without thinking, I reached out and shook it.
"No hard feelings on anything, Mickey. You're a damn good lawyer."
"Was," I thought. "Yeah," I said. "No hard feelings."
"You going to hang around and talk to jurors, see which way they were leaning?" he asked.
I shook my head. "No, I'm not interested."
"Me neither. Take care of yourself."
He clapped me on the shoulder and pushed out through the gate. I was sure there would be a throng of media out in the hall waiting, and he'd tell them that in some strange way, he felt that justice had been served. Live by the gun, die by the gun, or words to that effect. I'd leave the media for him. Instead, I gave him a good lead and then followed him out. The reporters were already surrounding him, and I was able to hug the wall and escape notice. All except for Jack McAvoy from the Times. He spotted me and started trailing. He caught me as I got to the stairwell entrance.
"Hey, Mick!"
I glanced at him, but didn't stop walking. I knew from experience not to. If one member of the media downed you, the rest of the pride would catch up and pile on. I didn't want to be devoured. I hit the stairwell door and started down. No comment. He stayed with me stride for stride.
"I'm not writing about the trial. I'm covering the new murders. I thought maybe you and I could have the same deal again. You know, trade information."
"No deal, Jack, and no comment. Catch you later." I put my hand out and stopped him on the first landing. I left him there, went down two more landings, and then out into the hallway on 11. I walked down to Judge Holder's courtroom and entered. Michaela Gill was in the clerk's pod, and I asked if I could see the judge for a few minutes.
"But I don't have you down for an appointment," she said.
"I know that, Michaela, but I think the judge will want to see me. Is she back there? Can you tell her I only want 10 minutes? Tell her it's about the Vincent files." The clerk picked up the phone, punched a button, and gave the judge my request. Then she hung up and told me I could go right back to her chambers. "Thank you." The judge was behind her desk with her half glasses on, a pen poised in her hand, as if I had interrupted her in the middle of signing an order.
"Well, Mr. Holler," she said, "it's certainly been an eventful day. Have a seat." I sat in the familiar chair in front of her.
Thank you for seeing me, Judge.
What can I do for you?
She asked the question without looking at me. She started scribbling signatures on a series of documents. I just wanted you to know I will be resigning as counsel on the rest of the Vincent cases. She put the pen down and looked over her glasses at me.
What?
I'm resigning. I came back too soon, or probably should never have come back at all. But I'm finished.
That's absurd. Your defense of Mr. Elliot has been the talk of this courthouse. I watched parts of it on television. You clearly were schooling Mr. Golance, and I don't think there were many observers who would have bet against an acquittal.
I waved the compliments away. Anyway, Judge, it doesn't matter. It's not really why I'm here. She took her glasses off and put them down on the desk. She looked hesitant, but then asked the next question.
Then, why are you here?
Because, Judge, I wanted you to know that I know. And soon enough, everybody else will as well.
I'm sure I don't know what you are talking about. What do you know, Mr. Holler?
I know that you are for sale, and that you tried to have me killed. She barked out a laugh, but there was no mirth in her eyes, only daggers.
Is this some kind of joke?
No, it's no joke.
Then, Mr. Holler, I suggest you calm down and compose yourself. If you go around this courthouse making these kinds of outlandish accusations, then there will be consequences for you. Severe consequences. Maybe you are right. You are feeling the stress of coming back too soon from rehab.
I smiled, and I could tell by her face that she immediately realized her mistake. Slipped up there, didn't you, Judge? How'd you know I was in rehab? Better yet, how did juror number 7 know how to lure me away from home last night? The answer is, you had me backgrounded. You set me up and sent McSweeney out to kill me.
I don't know what you were talking about, and I don't know this man you say tried to kill you.
Well, I think he knows you, and the last time I saw him, he was about to start playing Let's Make a Deal with the federal government. It hit her like a punch in the gut. I knew revealing it to her wasn't going to endear me to Bosch or Armstead, but I didn't care. Neither of them was the guy who had been used like a pawn and had nearly taken the high dive off of Mulholland. I was that guy, and that entitled me to confront the person I knew was behind it. I put it together without having to make a deal with anybody, I said. My investigator traced McSweeney. 9 years ago, he was arrested for an ADW, and who is his attorney? Mitch Lester, your husband. The next year he was popped again for fraud, and once again it was Mitch Lester on the case. There's the connection. It makes a nice little triangle, doesn't it? You have access to and control of the jury pool and the selection process. You can get into the computers, and it was you who planted the sleeper on my jury. Jerry Vincent paid you, but then he changed his mind after the FBI came sniffing around. You couldn't run the risk that Jerry might get jammed up with the FBI and try to deal a judge to them, so you sent McSweeney. Then, when it all turned to shit yesterday, you decided to clean house. You sent McSweeney, juror number 7, after Elliot and Albrecht, and then me. How am I doing, Judge? I miss anything so far? I said the word judge like it had the same meaning as garbage. She stood up. This is insane. You have no evidence connecting me to anyone but my husband, and making the leap from one of his clients to me is completely absurd.
You're right, Judge. I don't have evidence, but we're not in court here. This is just you and me.
I just have my gut instincts, and they tell me that this all comes back to you. I want you to leave now.
But the feds, on the other hand, they have McSweeney.
I could see it strike fear in her eyes.
Guess you haven't heard from him, have you?
Yeah, I don't think they're letting him make any calls while they debrief him. You better hope he doesn't have any of that evidence, because if he puts you in that triangle, then you'll be trading your black robe for an orange jumpsuit.
Get out, or I will call courthouse security and have you arrested!
She pointed toward the door. I calmly and slowly stood up.
Sure, I'll go. And you know something? I may never practice law again in this courthouse, but I promise you,
that I'll come back to watch you prosecuted. You and your husband. Count on it. The judge stared at me, her arm still extended toward the door, and I saw the anger in her eyes slowly change to fear. Her arm drooped a little, and then she let it drop all the way. I left her standing there. I took the stairs all the way down because I didn't want to get on a crowded elevator. 11 flights down. At the bottom, I pushed through the glass doors and left the courthouse. I pulled my phone and called Patrick and told him to pull the car around. Then I called Bosch. "I decided to light a fire under you and the bureau," I told him.
"What do you mean? What did you do?"
"I didn't want to wait around while the bureau took its usual year and a half to make a case. Sometimes justice can't wait, detective."
"What did you do, Haller?"
"I just had a conversation with Judge Holder. Yes, I figured it out without McSweeney's help. I told her the feds had McSweeney and he was cooperating. If I were you in the bureau, I'd hurry the fuck up with your case and in the meantime keep tabs on her. She doesn't seem like a runner to me, but you never know. Have a good day." I closed the phone before he could protest my actions. I didn't care. He had used me the whole time. It felt good to turn the tables on him, make him and the FBI do the dancing at the end of the string.
Part 6. The Last Verdict. Bosch knocked on my door early Thursday morning. I hadn't combed my hair yet, but I was dressed. He, on the other hand, looked like he had pulled an all-nighter.
"I wake you?" he asked.
I shook my head. "I have to get my kid ready for school."
"That's right. Wednesday nights and every other weekend."
"What's up, detective?"
"I've got a couple of questions, and I thought you might be interested in knowing where things stand on everything."
"Sure, let's sit out here. I don't want her hearing this." I patted down my hair as I walked toward the table.
"I don't want to sit," Bosch said. "I don't have a lot of time."
He turned to the railing and leaned his elbows down on it. I changed directions and did the same thing right next to him. "I don't like to sit when I'm out here either."
"I have the same sort of view at my place," he said. "Only, it's on the other side.
I guess that makes us flip sides of the same mountain." He turned his eyes from the view to me for a moment.
"Something like that," he said.
"So what's happening? I thought you'd be too angry with me to ever tell me what was going on."
"Truth is, I think the Bureau moves too slowly myself. They didn't like what you did very much, but I didn't mind. It got things rolling."
Bosch straightened up and leaned back on the railing, the view of the city behind him.
"So then, what's happening?" I asked. "The grand jury came back with indictments last night. Holder, Lester, Carlin, McSweeney, and a woman who's a supervisor in the jury office and was the one who gave them access to the computers. We're taking them all down simultaneously this morning. So keep it under your hat until we have everybody hooked up."
It was nice that he trusted me enough to tell me before the arrests. I thought it might be even nicer to go down to the CCB and watch them take Holder out of there in handcuffs.
"Is it solid?" I asked.
"Holder is a judge, you know. You better have it nailed down."
"It's solid. McSweeney gave it all up. We've got phone records, money transfers. He even taped her husband during some of the conversations."
I nodded. It sounded like the typical federal package. One reason I never took on federal cases when I was practicing was that when the big G made a case, it usually stayed made. Victories for the defense were rare. Most times you just got flattened like roadkill. "I didn't know Carlin was hooked up in this," I said.
"He's right at the center. He goes way back with the judge, and she used him to approach Vincent in the first place. Vincent used him to deliver the money. Then when Vincent started getting cold feet because the FBI was sniffing around, Carlin got wind of it and told the judge. She thought the best thing to do was get rid of the weak link. She and her husband sent McSweeney to take care of Vincent."
"Got wind of it how? Wren Williams?"
"Yeah, we think. He got close to her to keep tabs on Vincent. We don't think she knew what was going on. She's not smart enough."
I nodded and thought about how all the pieces fit together. "What about McSweeney? He just did what he was told? The judge tells him to hit a guy and he just does it?"
First of all, McSweeney was a con man before he was a killer, so I don't for a minute think we're getting the whole truth out of him. But he says the judge can be very persuasive. The way she explained it to him, either Vincent went down or they all went down. There was no choice. Besides, she also promised to increase his cut after he went through with the trial and tipped the case. I nodded. So what are the indictments? Conspiracy to commit murder? Corruption? This is only the first wave. There will be more down the road. This wasn't the first time. McSweeney told us he'd been on 4 juries in the last 7 years. 2 acquittals and 2 hangers. 3 different courthouses. I whistled as I thought of some of the big cases that had ended in shocking acquittals or hung juries in recent years. Robert Blake? Bosch smiled and shook his head. I wish, he said. OJ too, but they weren't in business back then for that one. We just lost those cases on our own. Doesn't matter. This is going to be huge. Biggest one I've ever had. He folded his arms and glanced over his shoulder at the view. You've got the Sunset Strip, and I've got Universal, he said. I heard the door open and looked back to see Haley peeking out.
Dad? What's up, hey? Is everything all right?
Everything's fine. Haley, this is Detective Bosch. He's a policeman. Hello, Haley, Bosch said. I think it was the only time I had ever seen him put a real smile on his face.
Hi,
my daughter said. Haley, did you eat your cereal? I asked.
Yes.
Okay, then you can watch TV until it's time to go. She disappeared inside and closed the door. I checked my watch. She still had 10 minutes before we had to leave. She's a cute kid, Bosch said. I nodded. I gotta ask you a question, he said. You started this whole thing tumbling, didn't you? You sent that anonymous letter to the judge. I thought for a moment before answering. If I say yes, am I going to become a witness? I had not been called to the federal grand jury after all. With McSweeney giving everything up, they apparently didn't need me, and I didn't want to change that now. No, it's just for me, Bosch said. I just want to know if you did the right thing. I considered not telling him, but ultimately, I wanted him to know. Yeah, that was me. I wanted to get McSweeney off the jury and then win the case fair and square. I didn't expect Judge Stanton to take the letter and consult other judges about it. He called up the chief judge and asked her advice. I nodded. It's gotta be what happened, I said. He calls her, not knowing she was behind the whole thing. She then tipped McSweeney and told him not to show up for court, then used him to try to clean up the mess. Bosch nodded, as though I was confirming things he already knew. And you were part of the mess. She must have figured you sent the letter to Judge Stanton. You knew too much and had to go, just like Vincent. It wasn't about the story we planted. It was about you tipping Judge Stanton. I shook my head. My own actions had almost brought about my own demise in the form of a high dive off Mulholland. I guess I was pretty stupid. I don't know about that. You're still standing. After today, none of them will be. There's that. What kind of deal did McSweeney cut? No death penalty in consideration. If everybody goes down, then he'll probably get 15. In the federal system, that means he'll still do 13. Who's his lawyer? He's got 2, Dan Daly and Roger Mills. I nodded. He was in good hands. I thought about what Walter Elliott had told me, that the guiltier you were, the more lawyers you needed. Pretty good deal for 3 murders, I said. 1 murder, Bosch corrected. What do you mean? Vincent, Elliot, and Albrecht. He didn't kill Elliot and Albrecht. Those 2 didn't match up. What are you talking about? He killed them and then he tried to kill me. Bosch shook his head. He did try to kill you, but he didn't kill Elliot and Albrecht. It was a different weapon. On top of that, it didn't make sense. Why would he ambush them and then try to make you look like a suicide? It doesn't connect. McSweeney is clean on Elliot and Albrecht. I was stunned silent for a long moment. For the last 3 days, I had believed that the man who killed Elliot and Albrecht was the same man who had tried to kill me, and that he was safely locked in the hands of the authorities. Now,
Bosch was telling me there was a second killer somewhere out there.
Does Beverly Hills have any ideas? I finally asked.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty sure they know who did it, but they'll never make a case.
The hits kept coming, one surprise after another.
Who?
The family.
You mean like the family, with a capital F, organized crime?
Bosch smiled and shook his head.
The family of Johann Rieltz. They took care of it.
How do they know that?
Lands and grooves. The bullets they dug out of the two victims were 9mm Parabellums, brass jacket and casing, and manufactured in Germany. BHPD took the bullet profile and matched them to a C-96 Mauser, also manufactured in Germany. He paused to see if I had any questions. When I didn't, he continued.
Over at BHPD, they're thinking it's almost like somebody was sending a message.
A message from Germany.
You got it.
I thought of Golenz telling the Rieltz family how I was going to drag Johann through the mud for a week. They had left rather than witness that, and Elliot was killed before it could happen.
Parabellum, I said. You know your Latin, detective?
Didn't go to law school. What's it mean?
Prepare for war. It's part of a saying. If you want peace, prepare for war.
What will happen with the investigation now?
Bosch shrugged.
I know a couple of Beverly Hills detectives who will get a nice trip to Germany out of it. They fly their people business class, with the seats that fold down into beds. They'll go through the motions and the due diligence, but if the hit was done right, nothing will ever happen.
How'd they get the gun over here?
It could be done. Through Canada, or Dare FedEx, if it absolutely, positively has to be there on time.
I didn't smile. I was thinking about Elliot, and the equilibrium of justice. Somehow, Bosch seemed to know what I was thinking.
Remember what you said to me when you told me you had told Judge Holder you knew she was behind all of this?
I shrugged.
What did I say?
You said, sometimes justice can't wait.
And?
And you were right.
Sometimes it doesn't wait.
In that trial, you had the momentum, and Elliot looked like he was going to walk.
So somebody decided not to wait for justice, and he delivered his own verdict.
Back when I was riding patrol, you know what we called a killing that came down to simple street justice?
What?
The brass verdict.
I nodded.
I understood. We were both silent for a long moment.
Anyway, that's all I know, Bosch finally said. I gotta go and get ready to put people in jail. It's going to be a good day.
Bosch pushed his weight off the railing, ready to go.
It's funny you coming here today, I said. Last night I decided I was going to ask you something the next time I saw you.
Yeah, what's that?
I thought about it for a moment and then nodded. It was the right thing to do.
Flip sides of the same mountain. Do you know you look a lot like your father?
He said nothing. He just stared at me for a moment, then nodded once and turned to the railing. He cast his gaze out at the city.
When did you put that together? He asked.
Technically last night, when I was looking at old photos and scrapbooks with my daughter. But I think on some level, I've known it for a long time. We were looking at photos of my father. They kept reminding me of somebody, and then I realized it was you. Once I saw it, it seemed obvious. I just didn't see it at first. I walked to the railing and looked out at the city with him.
Most of what I know about him came from books, I said. A lot of different cases, a lot of different women. But there are a few memories that aren't in books and are just mine.
I remember coming into the office he had set up at home when he started to get sick. There was a painting framed on the wall, a print actually, but back then I thought it was a real painting. The Garden of Earthly Delights. Weird, scary stuff for a little kid. The memory I have is of him holding me on his lap and making me look at the painting and telling me that it wasn't scary, that it was beautiful. He tried to teach me to say the painter's name. Hieronymus Bosch. Rhymes with anonymous, he told me. Only back then, I don't think I could say anonymous either. I wasn't seeing the city out there. I was seeing the memory. I was quiet for a while after that. It was my half-brother's turn. Eventually, he leaned his elbows down on the railing and spoke.
I remember that house, he said. I visited him once.
introduced myself. He was on the bed. He was dying.
What did you say to him?
I just told him I'd made it through. That's all. There wasn't really anything else to say. Like right now, I thought, what was there to say? Somehow, my thoughts jumped to my own shattered family. I had little contact with the siblings I knew I had, let alone Bosch. And then there was my daughter, whom I saw only 8 days a month. It seemed like the most important things in life were the easiest to break apart.
You've known all these years, I finally said. Why didn't you ever make contact?
I have another half-brother and 3 half-sisters. They're yours, too, you know.
Bosch didn't say anything at first. Then he gave an answer I guessed he had been telling himself for a few decades.
I don't know. I guess I didn't want to rock anybody's boat. Most of the time, people don't like surprises. Not like this.
For a moment, I wondered what my life would have been like if I had known about Bosch. Maybe I would have been a cop instead of a lawyer. Who knows? I'm quitting, you know. I wasn't sure why I had said it.
Quitting what?
My job, the law. You could say the brass verdict was my last verdict.
I quit once. It didn't take. I came back.
We'll see. Bosch glanced at me, and then put his eyes back out on the city. It was a beautiful day, with low-flying clouds and a cold air front that had compressed the smog layer to a thin, amber band on the horizon. The sun had just crested the mountains to the east and was throwing light out on the Pacific. We could see all the way out to Catalina.
I came to the hospital that time you got shot, he said. I wasn't sure why. I saw it on the news, and they said it was a gut shot, and I knew those could go either way. I thought maybe if they needed blood or something, I could. I figured we matched, you know? Anyway, there were all these reporters and cameras. I ended up leaving.
I smiled, and then I started to laugh. I couldn't help it.
What's so funny?
You. A cop, volunteering to give blood to a defense attorney. I don't think they would have let you back into the clubhouse if they knew about that.
Now Bosch smiled and nodded. I guess I didn't think about that.
And just like that, both our smiles disappeared, and the awkwardness of being strangers returned. Eventually, Bosch checked his watch.
The warrant teams are meeting in 20 minutes. I gotta roll.
Okay.
I'll see you around, counselor.
I'll see you around, detective. He went down the steps, and I stayed where I was. I heard his car start up, then pull away, and go down the hill. I stayed out on the deck after that, and looked out at the city as the light moved across it. Many different thoughts filtered through my head and flew off into the sky, like the clouds up there, remotely beautiful and untouchable. Distant. I was left feeling that I would never see Bosch again. That he would have his side of the mountain, and I would have mine, and that's all there would be. After a while, I heard the door open and steps on the deck. I felt my daughter's presence by my side, and I put my hand on her shoulder. What are you doing, Dad?
Just looking.
Are you all right?
I'm fine.
What did that policeman want?
Just to talk. He's a friend of mine.
We were both silent for a moment before she moved on. I wish Mom had stayed with us last night, she said. I looked down at her and squeezed the back of her neck.
One thing at a time, hey, I said. We got her to have pancakes with us last night, didn't we?
She thought about it and gave me the nod.
She agreed. Pancakes were a start.
I'm going to be late if we don't go, she said. One more time and I'll get a conduct slip.
I nodded.
Too bad. The sun's just about to hit the ocean.
Come on, Dad. That happens every day.
I nodded. Somewhere, at least.
I went in for the keys, then locked up and we went down the steps to the garage. By the time I backed the Lincoln out and had it pointed down the hill, I could see the sun was spinning gold on the Pacific.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Brass Verdict, written by Michael Connelly and read by Peter Giles.
The Brass Verdict was directed and produced by Linda Korn. It was recorded at the Media Staff. Digital editing and mastering by Dion Audio. Production supervised by Michelle McGonigal. The Brass Verdict is also available in print from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group USA. In no particular order, the author wishes to thank the following individuals for contributions to the research and writing of this story that range from small to incredibly selfless and gigantic. Daniel Daly, Roger Mills, Dennis Wojciechowski, Asia Muchnick, Bill Massey, S. John Drexel, Dennis McMillan, Pamela Marshall, Linda Connolly, Jane Davis, Shannon Byrne, Michael Peach, John Wilkinson, David Ogden, John Houghton, Michael Krikorian, Michael Roach, Greg Stout, Judith Champagne, Rick Jackson, David Lampkin, Tim Marsha, and Philip Spitzer. This is a work of fiction. Any errors in the law, evidence, and courtroom tactics are wholly those of the author. Text copyright 2008 by Hieronymus, Inc. Audio production copyright and published 2008 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.